Can you think of anything that talks other than a person?
A bird?
Yeah.
Sometimes a parrot talks.
He wasn't as sharp even against Sammy as he's been. He was still good, but he wasn't that spectacular good. He was still 19 years of age. I mean, it's a fear. There's a lot of other things that play a part in people's makeup.
Yeah, some birds are funny when they talk.
I mean, it's a theory.
Can you think of anything else?
I don't know.
Record.
The training you're doing may be taking a bit of juice from your leg. I mean, it's a theory. He's a player who's always in the focus and in the spotlight, both for Liverpool and England. Maybe that's had some effect. I don't know.
Well, if Roy doesn't know, we don't know. It's the Day Trippers. At the halfway point of yet another maddeningly pointless international layoff, there may be no proper football, but there are plenty of conversation points for us to discuss in tonight's show, which will feature our Tripper version of structured debate. Our goalkeeping guru Phil will tackle the subject of Simon Mignolet with Darren Kelly of Irish Pro Keepers. Plus, our lads will discuss the nebulous concept of momentum with pod debutants Dan Kennett and Joe Pepper. We'll also look at the other LFC stories dominating the news, from Jose's naked selfies to Hodgson throwing Raheem under the bus. In the bunker with me tonight are the aforementioned garish kid fancier Safe Hands Casey, Falcao first responder Andy Young, and, lest we get too positive, Damo Flood. Before we kick off tonight, you may have missed our Twitter feed, but fear not, you can tune in now. On Sunday coming, we're joining Neil Atkinson and John Gibbons from the Anfield Rap in the Stone Boat in Kimmage. We're helping them launch their Make a Stream book in Ireland, and in return, they're going to help us out with a bit of analysis for the QPR game. It's a free event, but there is limited space, so when it's full, you're not going to get in. So get yourself down to the Stone Boat by noon if you want to have a chance, or else the lads in YNWA Irish Reds, who are being generous hosts, may have to turn you away. As we said, it's a free entry, but obviously you have to buy the lads who are talking a pint. Okay, we want to start with a little chat about Simon Mignolet. Now, our Belgian keeper has divided opinion right from the beginning, but even his critics had to admit that he had a remarkable capacity for shot stopping. Now, lately, even that has been called into question, and his timidity and lack of presence have re-emerged. There's also been an increase in the unease of fans about the man in general. With the link of Victor Valdez continuing to be a thing, what does the future hold for Liverpool's current number one? Well, tonight we've invited in the man who's behind Irish Pro Keepers Coaching School to give us a coach's viewpoint on this. Darren Kelly, who's former Ipswich trainee, former Irish Defence Forces captain, and bitter club frenemy of our own Phil Casey. Welcome. Thanks for dropping into the bunker. Before we get started, Irish Pro Keepers, what's that all about, Darren?
Basically, the Irish Pro Keepers Academy was set up to develop Irish goalkeepers that we felt wasn't being developed correctly, especially with the GAA background and stuff like that. We thought we could develop a bit more and bring more of a professional approach for our goalkeepers, and using myself and Shane Supple's experience from travelling to England, we thought that we'd try and give something back to the kids of Ireland that want to progress into the football in a professional manner. And so far it's been quite successful.
And how long are you set up? And
we are set up about a year and a half now, over a year and a half. We started back in January 2013. Mm. So we've been going strong ever since. We've got international goalkeepers, DDSL goalkeepers, SDFL, NDSL. We've got lads travelling up from Carlow, Wexford, even up to Waterford. We have a Northern Irish under-14 international willing to travel down to train with us as well. So it's been quite successful in what we're doing.
That's fantastic. And how regular are the sessions there?
We've got academies in Crumlin on a Monday and a Wednesday night, and we've got one in Sallynoggin on a Thursday night. We're looking at a Northside venue of Dublin now as well. And we've got Wicklow opening up again fairly soon as well, so it's going good.
And just before we start talking about Mignolet, if people are listening and they want to get involved, or maybe they've got a son or a friend, or maybe it's themselves who want to get involved, do you guys have a central kind of address or a website or anything
like
that?
We have a website. It's www.irishprokeepers.com. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. we're quite swift in replies, of getting back to people, or you can contact us directly. On
class, thanks very much.
Just before I go, because I know Darren, I played against him for a good few years. Had the fortune of playing against him for a good few years. But look at the guys in IPK. I know Shane was involved. I know obviously Fowler's involved. Ian Fowler's involved with them as well. And one of the lads who I would have coached up at Wayside has also got involved in the coaching end with them. And the lads are literally on the edge in terms of what they do, in terms of what's available in Ireland. Like, it's true, Aaron, you've started to bring video analysis in for your senior goalkeepers, and this is like for guys who are amateur and semi-pro level.
What we've done is we've looked at where can we improve goalkeepers, and it goes right back to the basics. We're looking at the starting and the set position, and they are your foundations as a goalkeeper. It's vitally important to have a good starting position and being able to set for the shot. We're finding a lot of kids are jumping the wrong direction to where the ball's going. They're still moving when the ball's being struck. So what we've done is we've brought video analysis in, put it behind the lads, and when we're seeing shots, be it volleys, strikes off the deck, half volley, stuff like that, we're looking at them, how they're setting themselves and how they're moving. Is their balance correct? Is their set position right? How can we make it better for them? Try and get the timing correctly as well, because if you don't have the timing, that they're going all over the place, like they're never going to make the save, like, you know. So it's something that we feel vitally important, because the game is so technical, and goalkeeping is a specialist position. We feel that video analysis, to look at the goalkeeper and break him down, is to make him that bit better and give him the edge over what we're trying to do and other goalkeepers, like, you know. Yeah. So
that's brilliantly specific, actually, isn't it? It's just fantastic for kids to get that.
But we've also teamed up with Nada now as well, who trained the Dublin GAA team, who've been successful in the last couple of years. We've also teamed up with them, and we're getting goalkeepers and goalkeeping specific programs with them out in Blanchardstown. So we've got, at the minute, we've got a couple of elite goalkeepers going out and training with them. And the results of the NADA feedback has been superb. Like, some lads are jumping nowhere near where they should be jumping. They're jumping really, really high, and we're looking and saying, hold on, the spring work that they're doing from, and the balance and all that kind of stuff, is paying off, and you can see the spring now coming into the lads. And
just
all the stiff,
just in case stiff, people know, who are listening don't know, NADA is there. It's
the National Athletic Development Academy out in Blanchardstown.
Yeah.
And the boys are behind the Dublin senior team. They were with the hurling. Jim Gavin brought them in with the Dubs, and we also have Anne-Marie Kennedy, who was Sports Yoga Ireland as well. She works with the Dubs constantly on yoga as well. So we have had yoga sessions as well. So it's the whole breakdown. Or what can we do as an academy? It's not just basically we're here for training. We're here for the whole works.
Yeah.
And it's the whole network of stuff we're doing at the minute. Now, we're quite small at the minute, but we're quite effective, and that's where we want to be.
Well, I immediately want to export you across to Liverpool. So you could have a little bit of a word in the ear of a certain gent that we want to talk about. Yeah. Phil, do you want to get the ball rolling on that, maybe?
Yeah, look, and this is why I asked Darren to come in tonight, because I suppose every time we talk on it, we talk about, you know, what's going wrong, what isn't happening, etc., etc. I said, for a change, let's talk to a coach, you know, to someone who's in this area at the moment, who's been asked to improve, you know, goalkeepers at a lesser level, let's take it, would ask them to improve their game or change the game. The managers are coming to them and saying, look, my fella won't come off his line, he won't dominate his box, he won't talk to his defenders.
Same principles.
The exact same principle that's going on. As Darren was just saying, you know, all goalkeeping boils down to the same basics all the time, and it comes back to the same thing. Now, there's different techniques to get you, but everyone's talking about it. Nobody's talking about how we improve them, or is it possible to improve them, or what is the coach's viewpoint on this? And that's why I asked Darren in tonight, because I've been saying it for a while on this, that, you know, he's a reactive goalkeeper. He doesn't like to come off his line. And, you know, let's get a different voice in. Let's get somebody who knows what they're talking about, apart from me, who doesn't know what I'm talking about.
I'm glad you added that.
Jesus.
But no, in fairness, it's better to get a guy who's living now is this type of coach. And so, Darren, I suppose when I was talking to you about this, the idea is that if you have a goalkeeper, and I suppose the key idea about this is, if you're looking at goalkeeping styles, there's two distinct goalkeeping styles. And as we were talking before this, you've got a third, which is Manuel Neuer, who plays basically as a centre back or a midfielder at points during the actual game. But in general, there's a guy who likes to play high in his box, likes to dominate his area, and then you've got other goalkeepers who like to mainly stop shots and stay at the line. In your experience, and you running through the goalkeeping coaches and going through managers, etc., is it possible to change a goalkeeper's style fundamentally, to change him from a reactive shot-stopping type goalkeeper to a proactive sort of dominator of his box?
not only is it a goalkeeping issue as well, it's also an outfield issue. As experienced, like, you have to know what kind of system the team wants to play. Do the team want to press high? Do you want to drop off? And that dictates a goalkeeper's starting position. From the likes of Mignolet, I think he's been more highlighted this week about with Gary Neville and what he said on Sky Sports and stuff like that. It's hard to go in and change a goalkeeper's style, especially at that age and what he's been used to. But you also have to look at as well that Mignolet has changed clubs. He's gone into a new team. He has worked with a different goalkeeping coach, and that's tough. So that could be another factor on it as well. But the whole kind of thing is that the outfield coach and the goalkeeping coach have to work coincide with each other and discuss it, what way we're going to play. Are we going to drop off? Are we going to push up a bit more? And that dictates as well for the goalkeeping starting position. So these things have to come into play as well. It's not just about Wally and the goalkeeping coach. Why isn't he doing this? Why isn't he doing that? And it happens week in, week out. It happens week in, week out on schoolboy pitches around the country. My goalkeeper's not doing this. My goalkeeper's not doing that. My goalkeeper can't kick a ball. But that's your responsibility as a coach to get him doing that. So everyone has to take full responsibility. It's not just a goalkeeping coach having to take responsibility on the goalkeeper and how he plays the game. The goalkeeping coach and the outfield coach have to walk side by side and say, right, this is the way I want to play. I want a goalkeeper to play like that.
Mm.
So a lot of things come into play about how a goalkeeper plays. It's not just about nowadays keeping the ball out of the net. You've got to play as a 11 man outfield. Do you know that kind
and
of
Darren, way? As someone who's worked with keepers and tried to get them up to different kinds of spec, and as you say, it depends on the system what the requirements are. But we've seen a change in Mignolet in the basic things that he's doing.
Yeah.
Have you had that experience where a player, for whatever reason, loses a bit of confidence or whatever, and starts to go almost against the coaching, go back and retreat into themselves? Because that's almost seems like what's happened.
It's psychological.
Yeah.
It's every goalkeeper goes through it. Like, we've got other lads there. Another one, a friend of mine, has retired from football at the age of 28.
Mm.
You know, and it's psychological. It's only starting to come out now how much pressure is on the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. One comment in a game, you might have done some great things, and one comment from someone in the crowd knock your confidence off straight away, like, you know, and that'll start playing in your mind. Like, even if I'm playing a game on a Sunday or whatever, and you get this bar stool standing on the side of the pitch, that plays in your mind straight away, and you're starting to doubt yourself because you're on your own.
Yeah.
And the little men start talking in each ear and saying blah blah blah, and you know yourself, from standing outside on your own on a freezing cold Sunday morning,
I turn around and have a row with them just because that's
well, it's all psychological. And with the whole Victor Valdes in the background as well, that's obviously playing on his mind as well.
Well, that's kind of where I wanted to go next with that. Like, I mean, what sort of effect is that having on him, do you think? Like, I mean, realistically speaking, you talk about you're on your own, but that's obviously part of the coaching as well, to be prepared to be on your own, and to be prepared to be concentrating, like, all the time for a seconds of action. So
it's mental. It's more mental now than physical, like with a goalkeeper. Like, it's so hard for the mind to stay focused for 90 minutes. Can't concentrate. You're trying as much as you can concentrate for 90 minutes, and that's when the self-doubt creeps in. And you're wondering, am I doing this right, am I doing that right? Oh God, what happens if this happens? What am I going to do? And you start one mistake, one bad goal kick will destroy a whole confidence.
And I suppose that's one of the things I've always questioned about the level of mental strength that he might carry, because he always seems to bounce back from a mistake fairly well, right? But overall, like, I'll go back to the Manchester City game this season. When he played the Southampton game, he was high in his box. He was up off his line. He was behind the back four. He was, you know, coming for crosses and the whole lot. City, he played very similar, but straight away, on the third goal it was, he seemed to get caught out of position because he wasn't quite, like, you know, he was playing much higher and Aguero was able to slot the ball past him into almost an empty goal. And you know, the criticism that was levelled after that was, what's Mignolet doing standing there? And ever since then, he looks uneasy now in his position on the thing. How would you, if you have a goalkeeper like that, right, and is coming to you, is part of the academy, and he says to you, listen, I'm fucking, you know, my nerve is gonna be here. I'm not quite sure what I'm meant to be doing. My goalkeeping coach wants me up the top of my box.
Yeah.
But, you know, I keep getting caught out there.
Yeah.
How do you turn this fella around? Where do we work? Do you work? Is that you focusing on him mentally, or how do you get him to?
Well, first of all, strip him back down. Like, what they say is, how do you build morale? You break it down, you build it back up. How do you build a goalkeeper? You break them down, you build them back up. Straight back to basics. Let's start getting them back confidence. Let's start building this, building up his handling, his footwork. Let's go back right to basics. It's like Rocky in Rocky 3, I think it was, when he went back, he was chasing the chicken, he couldn't catch it. we laugh about it.
Yeah.
But even though it was a film, he went back with Apollo, got himself back up, and he went and fought. And yeah. that's what you got to do with a goalkeeper. You got to bring him back down. Let's get back again, and we build you back up again. Like, I remember going away there a couple of years ago with Les Ealy when I went to West Ham, and he had a plan for us to go walking on the building site for 2 weeks, and getting up at 5 in the morning, going out, there's your lunch, off you go. That's what he had done when he was there. He's got them out in the building site. Take away what they have, the good things, and give them, this is your life. Do you know that kind of way? So it's about building up the character again of a goalkeeper, making them more determined again. And stuff like that, you know, you have to go back and really build the goalkeeper back up, because they're sensitive. Do you know what I mean? We are the sensitive bunch, like.
Yeah.
And you do think about
you
it.
You tell them.
But like, you have to think about it. And the other thing, like, you have to trust your goalkeeper. You don't trust your goalkeeper, bang, you may forget about it.
Going back to where he's commonly criticised on his distribution, right?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you're working with keepers on the distribution, right? I've often said that his accuracy isn't too bad because he finds the players where he wants, right? But it's very slow. Now, I think that a core component in terms of the, you know, the really good goalkeepers is very quick distribution. How do you work with goalkeepers to see their next pass? Because, you know, it's like a midfielder. The best midfielders in the world know where the players are on the pitch and know as the ball is coming into them where it's going to next. Yeah. He always seems to have to take the ball and then see where things are. How do you work with that, you know, to improve the perception of what's going on in front of them?
Like, it's a good question, like. But again, at the same time, if he doesn't take his time, that ball could go through his hands and he'd be criticising him again after that. So if he goes and goes for the ball and he takes a look and he takes his eye off and it goes in the back of the net, you're criticising for that.
Mm.
Like, we walk on, constantly walking on, catch the first ball, make the first save, second save will come. And stuff like that, if you do a crossing session, come catch the ball, watch your next move. Get the ball in your hands first, then you distribute it. Like, there's no, yeah, you have a quick glance, you kind of know what's going on because the position, you can see the whole field.
But well, it'll depend a lot on the relationship between, say, the goalkeeper and the striker who's going to move all the time. Like, if Mignolet has that option, like, I always remember Reina would pick out Torres because they knew exactly what was going on every time. Yeah. So, do you blame the goalkeeper or do you blame the players who aren't giving them a dig out? Because, you know, they're working all week. All they have to do is say, well, that's what I'm going to do. Every time you catch the ball at a corner, I'm going there.
Yeah. When I play with some good players. I play with Darren Bentley, Darren Ambrose. I used to have this thing. I looked at my front man first. I look at throwing into feet. Mm. What can I do? And that, I got that from the Ipswich coaches. I learned from the coaches that I had there. So, and I was lucky enough that I had Paul Goddard that was there as well. So he was a striker. So I kind of listened to him and what he was going to do. I used to catch the ball straight and look for a striker's feet. And in fairness to the lads, you knew what I was kind of going to do. Yeah. You know that? Because I worked on it in training. Bang.
Yeah.
What am I going to look for? If it's not on up top, I'm going to come into midfield. Then I look to play off in the back.
Yeah.
And slow it down. But like you see now, his first movement is bang, going forward. Because he's that kind of goalkeeper. Do you know that kind of way?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He knows, and them players know, right, if Neuer gets it, I'm going into space because I know he's gonna find me.
Yeah.
But if again the players are not walking, that's the coach's fault. That's the outfield coach's fault.
Yeah.
That goes back to the coaching of the team again. Like, are we gonna move the ball quickly? On what happens, like
Neuer's a very commanding goalkeeper. He puts the pressure on the striker to move for him.
Yeah.
Where if you have maybe Mignolet is a bit more reserved than in himself, he probably doesn't have the confidence. Yeah. At last year with Suarez, the ball came out, or this year with Sturridge, like they're big characters.
Do you think it's possible, though, ultimately, for him to fundamentally change his style? And that's a straight up question because I see lots of technical issues in terms of speeding up, like what you said, in terms of speeding up distribution and the whole lot.
Yeah.
I think you can always improve accuracy. Accuracy is something that can always be worked on, right? Yeah. But in terms of speed, I'm not sure how you develop quicker distribution if somebody, as you said, isn't from that mindset. So it's like some people see a pass, some people have to take it and then see what's going on. And that's where I'm trying to figure out, can he change that about himself, or are you accepting that that's the style of goalkeeper? You've signed that goalkeeper. That's who you've signed. You knew what he was like before he came to the club.
Yeah.
if you want them to be a completely different goalkeeper, then you actually went down the wrong path. And that's.
But it's the same, like, you know, with Valdes, who's a complete opposite goalkeeper, Mignolet, that he's played for Barcelona, it's distribution, he's playing football constantly.
Mm.
You know, and that's the philosophy of Barcelona, is tiki-taka football and playing football, with which Brendan Rodgers goes with as well. So he's going to fit into that kind of mould as well that Liverpool wants. So it's a tactical kind of thing. But going back to that question, he has to adjust his game to suit the Liverpool style of play.
Mm.
And it's up to the goalkeeper to work hard and change his style of play as well. But not only the goalkeeper, your outfield coach has to come in as well and work with the goalkeeping coach and the goalkeeper to change that. And not just go in and say, do this, do that. Go in and show them what you want. Do you know that kind of way? And like, you see a week in, week out, with going back to kids. I went and watched the game there a couple of months ago, and the coach is shouting at the goalkeeper, you're not talking, you're not doing this, you're not doing that. Now, I'd never seen the goalkeeper, and the goalkeeper is standing with his hands behind his back and looking with the puppy eyes, like. And I approached him and I said, have you shown him how to do it? What do you mean? Have you gone in and shown him how to talk to the back four? Have you shown him how to play in behind his defence? So it goes back to that then again, the knowledge of the outfield coach to a goalkeeper. Do you know that kind of way? They should be in walking side by side again with the goalkeeping coach and what you want to achieve.
My last thing of this, right? Given that Reina's form fell off a cliff since Rafa left, right? And his confidence was destroyed. And we're looking at a goalkeeper who's struggling with another thing, right? If there's a concentrate emerging in terms of what's there in terms of the coaching, is it sometimes a question to say, well, actually, maybe better to change your goalkeeping coach first, stick with the man that you have, change your goalkeeping coach and see if, you know, get somebody in, maybe from the Spanish style, maybe from the German style, to see, okay, can we change the way we're going to play here? Is it better to get a different type of communication from the goalkeeper, maybe a different style to bring him through as the type of goalkeeper that I want?
It's a big question to ask. Do you know that kind of way? Do you keep a goalkeeping coach that has done the business? Like, and again, referring back to De Gea, he worked with Eric Steele, who not only changed his goalkeeping habits, he changed his physique, he changed everything about him. And you've seen the rewards that he got from it. Do Liverpool do that? That's the question that Rodgers has to ask himself. What kind of goalkeeping coach have it to get in? Because there's different styles. The Germans will defend from the line, apart from Neuer, like, do you know that kind of way? But the Spanish should be a totally different concept of goalkeeping again, and same with the Irish and the English. We've all got different concepts. So it's what suits your kind of philosophy of football that you've got to go and get. And it's not only about changing, you've got to have the right players to play. And if they want to play that, it's got to be a change of goalkeeper in my eyes to play that kind of football that Liverpool want to play. And it's just bring Valdes in, and Valdes comes in and serious things happen. Do you blame the goalkeeping coach? And that's the ultimate question, is the goalkeeping coach is there to bring on the goalkeepers. And one person can knock your confidence. Do you know? And one person walking down the road can knock your confidence. Do you know that kind of way? And that confidence, goalkeeping is on confidence. And if you have a competent goalkeeper enjoying himself, you'd be the best in the world. If you have a goalkeeper gone inside him, you may forget about it.
Well, Darren, nice to have someone who's not a complete spoofer in the bunker. Really, really appreciate your thoughts.
Thanks.
That's a terrible thing to call yourself.
I'm aware of it. I'm okay. Right, we wanted to have a quick chat about the idea of momentum. So after recording a much-needed 3 points against West Brom, Liverpool's road back to some consistent form was blocked by the police checkpoint that is international fortnight. Was this a good or a bad thing? Did the spectre of Hodgy and his national management buddies disrupt Liverpool's momentum, or was it, contrarily, perfectly timed? And what is this momentum malarkey anyway? It's a term that's much loved by television pundits, but what does it actually mean, and does it really exist? So joining us on the line are two of Liverpool's finest football writers, Dan Kennett and Joe Pepper, to debate that very topic. Dan, I'll start you first, and maybe you could talk to us about your concept of momentum and whether or not it's a real issue.
Wow. like the idea of being invited on just for a quick chat about momentum, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we knew you were free, so.
A couple of minutes.
Yeah, yeah. We can get this one done and dusted in 2 minutes.
Excellent.
Yeah. right. So, firstly, the thing is what do we think it means is where to start? Because I think it means different things to different people. And then once we can get an idea of all our different flavours of what we think momentum is, then we've got to think about the question, okay, does any of it matter? So if you think about, I'm just going to start the ball rolling with what my definition is. I'm not going to go into the confidence side and the psychological side because I'm sure you guys will do that. But the confidence thing is, it's just like if you've gathered momentum, are you more likely to win your next game, or are you more likely to score your next penalty kick, or are you more likely to score your next free throw shot based on the fact that you scored your last one? And this idea that you can build momentum through doing something. Now, the problem is that if you want to prove momentum exists, you have to show that the momentum has caused something to happen which wouldn't otherwise have happened only by chance.
Mm.
So let me give you a really, in layman's terms, I break it down, right? This is the whole thing about causality or post hoc, ergo propter hoc, okay? So I'm going to give you a really simple example of Christmas. So two things happen at Christmas time. Well, many things happen at Christmas time. I'm going to give you two examples, right? Firstly, people send Christmas cards at Christmas. And secondly, people buy scarves and gloves at Christmas time. Now, one of those things is causal. The other is not. Right? People buy scarves and gloves because it's winter time. Now, they also happen to might buy scarves and gloves as Christmas presents. But, you know, that's by the by.
Mm.
People only send Christmas cards when it's Christmas time.
Yeah.
You get the difference?
Yeah. I'm with you. I suppose, Dan, what I'm wondering is where are you trying to drive this argument, Danny? Are you trying to say that basically there's no Santa Claus? Are you trying to say, this idea of causality and one thing leading to another, right? Can you give us a football kind of example in terms of, you know, where you can see that basically, you know, momentum isn't necessarily something that happens every time?
Yeah, because you could win six games in a row, right?
Yeah.
But that's not necessarily evidence of momentum.
Yeah.
That could have happened naturally anyway.
Right.
You know, like you could lose six in a row. Because good teams win, right?
Yeah.
Bad teams can also win. Teams with confidence can win, but teams with no confidence can also win. It's, you know, but when a team with no confidence wins, it's usually called winning ugly or something like that, or the sign of a good team or some other cliche. You know?
I see what you're saying.
I could give a couple of examples for where it pops up quite a lot with Liverpool and with, you know, our own experiences with football, for example. How often do you guys remember Gerard Houllier saying, "We've turned a corner"?
Yeah, he liked his corners, Gerard.
He lived on a big roundabout, so
So that always struck me as I always used to get really annoyed when Houllier said that, because I used to think, you know, it's like the 12th time you've said it in the last year. It's bollocks, because every time we turn a corner, we get stuck in another one again in the next game. Mm. And another good example would be like Michael Owen or someone like that. He'd often be on a goal drought. Like, he wouldn't have scored for five games. He just needs one goal and then he'll get a whole host of goals. Or he just needs one to go in off his backside. How many times have you heard that? That's like a common example of it being used.
Ricky.
But the reason why this all became like a kind of a hot topic relating to Liverpool for like the likes of me and Dan was because where this would come up is Liverpool would be, you know, struggling in the league. They'd have injuries mounting. They'd be, you know, trying to get a place in the top four, maybe under Rafa or, you know, later on under Kenny. And the debate would often come up where Liverpool would have a League Cup game or an FA Cup game. There would be an argument over whether or not Liverpool should rest players and basically risk losing the game because, you know, you don't care about winning the League Cup anywhere. And oftentimes, the argument in favour of picking the strongest possible team was that gives you momentum. It basically means that you're going to win the game. And in turn, just by the act of winning that game, is going to make you more likely to win the next one.
Yeah, fair enough. To give a kind of contrary viewpoint then, Floody, What's your feeling? Maybe take it from your own playing days, on the idea of getting momentum, the idea of it being a real thing that players are aware of and feel going into a match.
It definitely, for me, when I play it in a dressing room, it is something that can play on the mind of a player. When I've done coaching with kids as well, I've found the exact same thing as well. It becomes a habit. Winning becomes a habit, and it's kind of, it all embraces certain elements of that. You get the win, which breeds the confidence. Then it's the coaching on top of that, and then like the lads start to feel invincible, basically. And they start doing things right, and habits become good habits. And they say, well, we won that game because, especially if you detail after the game, you go through what you've done, and you look at it and say, well, we've done these things correctly. And then you point out what we've done incorrectly, and then you take out the kind of the negatives. And then you say, if we do that next week, we can go again, win another game. And that does happen, I've found. But it also, on the flip side, when you lose a game, it can go the opposite way as well. The confidence starts to drain out of the side. They start to question, do silly things that they shouldn't have been doing. So I fully believe momentum. Myself and Phil played in a side. We weren't the best side in the world. But we got into a situation in a very difficult league. And I think we went 10 games in the spin. Yeah. I don't think we conceded in one of them.
No, we were favourites to be relegated that year, and we ended up finishing third in the league from it, right? And like that, what happened was, sort of going back to a bit what Joe's just said around, you know, and Dan saying that one game in isolation doesn't, you know, create momentum. But for me, momentum is something that's created off the back of changing the opposition's mindset about how they approach you. So if you just go from being a team that's been looked at as being a poorer team to a team that's now looked at as being one that's hard, difficult to beat, primarily, and most of this stems around home form. It's like away form is a strange thing, but if you can build and back-to-back wins on things that's going on, teams then change their mindset as they come to play you. And that, for me, is where momentum is built from. And
I think that's a really interesting argument. Is that Phil?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting argument, actually, Phil. And I do think that's a very interesting way of, you know, I don't think that's a traditional way that, you know, there's been so many studies in US sports, especially basketball, baseball, NFL, whatever, about momentum. But I don't know if anyone's actually taken it from that, you know, that perspective. You know, like you want to build up a bastion of invincibility, you know, the Shankleyism, yeah? And then so other teams are actually fearing almost coming to you, so they're inhibited in some way. Yeah, I think that's definitely definitely more plausible. But can I just go back to what Damo said?
Yeah.
Right. About, you know, everybody believes in momentum. That's the thing. Everyone believes it, right? But just because people believe it doesn't mean it's true. Now, no, the flip side of that is absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, okay? So it's the two sides of the same coin, isn't it? Or you could put it, you could just talk about God if you wanted to, I guess. But, you know.
It depends on whether God has momentum or not.
He's 1-4 on the bounce.
I'm going to tell anybody to stop doing something that makes them feel good. Never.
Yeah.
Right? However, whether it makes any actual difference is a completely different thing. But people should, if doing something makes somebody feel good, they should do it. But that's like a placebo, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, what about that idea then, Dan, of what Philly was saying about habits? And maybe, Joe, you can come in after Dan here on this, about, you know, it becomes something, doing things the right way, as you've just said, becomes a habit. Then you have the situation which you've talked about, which is that habit getting disrupted because the momentum is lost, or is it because you have a loss? So do you change the habits and so on and so forth? Like, is that where your skepticism is arising from in relation to this whole concept?
It's right. So people who argued that momentum doesn't exist, and they've actually said they've proven it in the studies that it doesn't exist, but what they always say is that I've won the argument on hot hands, or I've won the argument on momentum 100 times, but I've convinced no one by winning the argument. So people still believe in it, even though they've just been proved wrong. So it doesn't really matter, almost, at the end of the day. What people believe is almost more important than what's true.
Yeah. Joe, would you concur with that there?
You know, Dan's almost there seems to be taking the position of it doesn't matter, you know, almost like it's harmless if you believe it and it doesn't really exist. But most of the actual proper research that's been done on this suggests that it is actually slightly harmful. And that's a bit counterintuitive, but Trev, you were mentioning about how, you're kind of putting into practice the correct methods which are proving to be successful. But that's almost just, that's not really momentum. That's just getting good at something. And when we talk about momentum, what we're really talking about is, does an instance of having success make you more likely to have success in the future than you otherwise would have been, all other things being equal?
Yeah.
If you're going to do well in the future, could that cause you to actually do better than you otherwise would do if you didn't have that internal better prediction? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Andy, would you kind of row in behind this idea that basically momentum is something maybe that happens as a result of this confidence, and that like it's a byproduct, it's not really a thing in itself. You're confident, you do well, and that it's as simple as that.
Yeah, I think what makes this a debate is people's interpretation of momentum. Mm. So when somebody mentions the word momentum, you're going to interpret it the way you see it.
Mm.
Now, before this was, it's a weird one to discuss. So I would have just thought it was purely confidence. Mm. So, you know, if your team are winning or a striker's not, you know, striker's banging in the goals, he's confident. And the momentum, momentum in its real meaning is, you know, it's a physical object moving forward, you know. So when we apply it to sport, it's just a metaphor kind of thing. It's not really a real thing,
yeah.
You know, definition of the word. So, I would say momentum is the likes of McElroy there. He's not won a major, he's not won a tournament in a while, and all of a sudden, one clicks, and next thing, he's shooting the lights out every time he plays golf, because he believes in himself. Right, and then the media and the commentators say the momentum is with him. But it's actually not really, it's just a figure of speech, I think. Mm. So when you break it down, yeah, it means nothing. But sure, how often do you say things in football that mean nothing?
Quite a lot. especially in here, mate.
Yeah, but you can look at, if a team's not playing well, if Liverpool are coming up against a team that's maybe lost the last four or five, people are going to start saying, let your performance.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden there's an argument to say that just when you're playing shit, which is you win.
Which is the exact opposite idea of.
Yeah. Or a team's winning. We used to say it last year a lot. Jeez, I can't see Liverpool winning 12 games in a row. Or will we start 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8? And eventually, it has to stop somewhere.
Yeah.
And bang, it supports the lads' arguments. Just because they won the last 11 doesn't mean they win their 12th.
Jump in.
Can I just come in there, Trev?
So? Yeah, of course.
So that kind of hits the nail on the head. It seems to be like what most people interpret it as. The idea that confidence makes you perform better is what we, or at least certainly I am saying, is definitely false. And in fact, all of the data suggests that it makes you perform slightly worse. So usually when you have this discussion, and I think, Damo was mentioning it with, say, well, I do better when I'm confident. And, use football as an example. People say, well, why do you do better when you're confident? Well, a good example would be if you're a striker, if you're confident, you're going to take a shot when you otherwise wouldn't have had the confidence to, and you might have passed it. It's the reverse side, which is basically overconfidence and complacency. So a good example of that might be Balotelli, who definitely isn't lacking in confidence, but as a result of him being confident, does he basically take more shots than he otherwise realistically should do? Should he pass it more often? And is he suffering from overconfidence? Where this gets really interesting is relating to Liverpool. And a guy on the Tompkins Times website called Graham Riley, who basically compiled a statistical database of all of the results in English league football history ever. And when we have all the results that Liverpool have had following a game that they won, versus all of the results Liverpool have had following a game that they lost, you would expect is in the games, the results in games that followed a win would be better results than the results in those games that followed a loss.
Yeah.
Is when you compare the two results, the results on the right-hand side, on the pile of results that follow a defeat, are actually better than the ones that... It also completely obliterates the whole factor of the fact that the teams in the first set of results are better than the teams in the second set of results.
Yeah.
What it actually suggests is a huge, huge underplayed factor of overconfidence and complacency.
Dan, on Joe's thoughts there, would you echo a lot of that stuff, or would you find yourself thrown in with a lot of what he's saying there?
I do go along with a lot of what he says, and it's just a terrible shame that he's got such a dodgy phone line. The satellite link to LA, you need, guys, you need to upgrade your infrastructure, I think.
That's next week.
I do agree with a lot of what he says, of course. Just what I wanted to pick up on what I think it was Damo said about Rory McIlroy. I don't know how old you are, guys, but you know, in the 70s there was a really good golfer called Gary Player, and Gary Player, the same thing was said about him, and he was often accused of being lucky and winning because he was lucky, and then, you know, the funny thing is the more I practice, the luckier I get. Is it just the fact that Rory McIlroy is actually the best player in the world that he wins lots of majors?
Yeah, fair enough, Andy.
On the bit, and I suppose it's very much, although it's a concept that's used by everyone, as Dan says, and it's accepted by everyone, right? I think even taking the five of us, we all have a different view on what the component parts of momentum are. The only thing that's common amongst the whole lot is the concept is that a team wins an awful lot of matches. And teams, you know, and they build something that other teams can't actually stop against, that the force of the wins that they build will be greater than the sum of the teams that they're going to play against. Now, for me anyway, as I said, the idea of momentum is that poor teams can achieve momentum in results, similar to, say, Ferguson's last couple of United teams, who are able to somehow put the results in the bag in title run-ins, where if you actually put them under a different manager, as we've seen with David Moyes, they couldn't put the same amount of results together. And it's, again, for me, the key in this whole thing is how the opposition sees you as a team, as opposed to necessarily the mental side of it in your own head. Because if the teams approach it in a different way, your chances of winning, in my opinion, now, I'm sure there's probably statistics to say I'm wrong, but the way that they will look at you will actually increase the probability of you actually winning matches. But I'm a qualitative person, so that's just...
Can I just ask one question there, Joe? That lad who compiled a lot of results over the year, from that was purely taken into Liverpool. What I would kind of... I'd love to find out is all them teams that beat Liverpool, and we're looking at the Liverpool's next result out there and saying, well, we won some, we lose some, there wasn't any momentum there. I'd like to actually see if any of them teams that beat us, what their next game was like, and after that and so forth. Were they building momentum? Not just us. Like, so if you had a West Ham team, say, that beat Liverpool, we're looking at our next game, we go and we beat QPR. Say, fuck it, that's not momentum. But did West Ham beating us create momentum for them? Momentum is just not a Liverpool thing. Like,
that's a good question, you know? And I honestly don't know.
I think he did have that, Joe, because his database, guys, is the he's actually one of the guys behind LFCHistory.net and the Liverpool Encyclopedia and all those good stuff. So he's actually part of the site there. And there was some discussion on the site, Joe, about he did it for all teams, not just Liverpool as well. So and the results broadly held. My view of that as a statistician would be that, you know, if you take the sample of every result played in English football ever, you've got a very big, a very big sample. And you take Liverpool as a representative sample of that, and our results match true against the wider picture. But, you know, just come back to what Phil was saying. The crux of the matter is it means different things to different people. And what you described there, going back to Ferguson, you know, one of the things about momentum is it confidence, or is it a confidence trick? Now, Ferguson did this thing where he got other teams almost giving up before they even came to play Man United at Old Trafford. Now, that's a whole host of things. You could say it's intimidation, or bullying or whatever. Yeah. You know, people like Mick McCarthy, he was there with Wolves. He didn't even bother trying. He sent a B team, didn't he, one time? Well, that's more like a confidence trick rather than confidence, isn't it? Which is the anti-momentum confidence trick, isn't it?
Yeah.
We'll
have to invent a word for anti-momentum.
Anti-momentum is brilliant. I love this.
Negamentum.
That's actually fantastic.
Monumental.
As the Americans say it, the Americans call it no-mentum, don't they?
No-mentum will do nicely. Well, with your statistician's hat on and notions of randomness in your head, how do you feel the game is going to go next time out for Liverpool?
I should add, I'm a complete I'm not an expert on this at all. I'm just a knobhead on the internet.
Good lad. Join the club. So anyway, Joe, what do you think?
We're playing QPR, right?
There you go.
Away.
11-0.
Excellent. This is our kind of thing. Dan, your thoughts on how you think it'll go in a nutshell?
If we don't beat QPR, we're fucked.
Right.
The momentum's going to be
no good. Momentum.
Yeah, honestly, I think if we even at this stage, if we can't win games like QPR away this season, I think top four is going to be a big ask.
Yeah.
Great. Okay. Fair enough.
Okay.
Dan, Joe, thanks a million, lads, for your thoughts. Appreciate it very much. A little mention of QPR there, so let's continue with that idea. Daniel Sturridge back, and he is massive for us. Does he start? Do you reckon?
Yeah, I've never been so relieved to see the man back. Mm. You know, it's what a lift it's going to give the team. I mean, straight away now is a goal threat going on there, which hasn't been in quite a few games.
Yeah.
So good to have him back. Like, you know, it's going to be a difficult one because there's such an important game coming up a few days later. But I believe he starts.
And it's the thing as well, isn't it, about not just him as a goal threat, but his presence, movement, all the rest of it adds the goal threat from the others around him, doesn't it, as well?
Yeah, everything. I mean, it gives the opposition something to think about. Like, playing Liverpool has been quite easy for the opposition for the last few games. They haven't had an awful lot to worry about. All of a sudden they see Sturridge there and they know he can produce magic out of anything. So again, yeah, it takes a little bit of a focus off players that there might have been a bit of pressure on. You might see something out of Balotelli.
Yeah,
just on the pure fact that not everyone, the eyes aren't on him now.
Mm.
You know, and if Markovic was playing, I know he's fit there again. You never know. Like, they might produce the goods just because the focus is off them.
Is off them and maybe onto the other man. Floody, is it a risk to start him straight away, do you think? Like, should he be introduced gradually or?
No, I'd start him straight away. Yeah. I believe... Always have said it. If a player I can fly. If a player is fit enough to be on the bench, he should start.
Yeah.
Like, he's every much at risk of getting injured coming off the bench. He's probably more at risk because he's warmed up. He's sat down. He's got cold again. At least he's done a full warm up and he's straight into the game. Then
momentum.
You know, there's momentum of warming up. So, but he's gone into the game and he's had a proper warm up. If he does that, then he sits on the bench, gets cold again. You're not really at the same level. The heart isn't pumping as quick at that stage. But you're into the game, so I'd start him if he's available to play. I get him on the pitch.
Yeah.
If he kind of blows up after 60 minutes and he can't breathe,
that'll be on television.
That's when you take him off, though. You know, I'd rather see that and us being on the front foot because he's the only striker we have that gives us that option of running behind.
Exactly. Like,
Balotelli doesn't do it. Lampard, God fucking knows he'll never do it. Yeah. That's what I said. Yeah, he doesn't do it either. He's not going to do it. He just runs the opposite way.
Yeah.
But he's the only threat we have there, don't it? Because when you're playing against teams, they're going to play a rigid back four. They're going to play five across the middle again.
Yeah.
So they know they toyed with the three. They won't do that this weekend. And they'll sit deep. But once we've that threat and movement, it's a lot easier to break teams down. When we only have Balotelli up top, it may be Lambert, we struggle because they don't stretch teams.
Mm.
They don't stretch teams. Where Sturridge is the only player we have that can do that.
Yeah.
So for me, straight into the team.
If we take it that he does start then, Phil.
I don't think he does. But anyway, go on.
Well, okay. Well, then maybe.
And the only reason I think the history of Sturridge coming back from injuries, Rodgers has tended to start him on the bench and then brought him in. Mm. Thinking Stoke away last year when he came on and had the real impact from the bench.
He had Luis Suarez, though.
I know he had Luis Suarez, but I'm just thinking that they may. Contrary to what you think, that they'll rather give him a half an hour.
I think they'll leave him on the bench, but if it was me, I'd start him.
If you look at it, he was a late call. He was nearly going to be available to be on the bench against Everton. Okay, yeah. And then he just went no, and he didn't play against Basel. And he did another game then West Brom, and he's probably looked at that and says, "This is perfect." You know, one game we leave him out, another for one more game, and then it's a full week, so it's a full 2 weeks now to get him ready to start.
I don't,
he's nearly available for the bench 2 weeks ago, he's bound to be available.
I don't think there's any one of us here that wouldn't start him if we were in.
There's the added fuck you to Hodgie as well if he starts.
I think he starts, and you know, I think he starts.
I think he starts.
I think he should. I think he should start. I think he will start.
Well, if he does, then what does the front line look like? Is it him and Balotelli with three behind?
Yeah, I think it will be him and Balotelli. There's been too much said with the whole Sterling being tired thing now that I doubt he plays. I doubt he starts.
Yeah.
So you put Lallana in behind in that 10 row because he's been playing so well, and put Balotelli and Sturridge up front and give them a nightmare.
And Phil, you don't agree? You don't think he's going to start? You think he's going to run the bench?
I don't disagree with the concept that Andy's put there. Like that, I totally back that. Like if he starts, that would be delightful.
Right, but what do you think is a realistic starting?
I can't see much changes from the last game with the exception of Lovren if he's injured, and then it's a case of does Touré come back in or is Sacco fit enough? Because on the Tuesday they said 10 days until Sacco was fit, which would put him right back. He'd be fit, say, Friday or Saturday going on the number of days until then, and he'd be ready for the actual Sunday game itself now. Then, but look, you're going to be looking at potentially coming back from injury, Chan, Allen, Sacco, right? Ready to come back. And then you've also got John Glenson, who I never want to see on the pitch, right? So anyway, if you're going to go for one of the injured players, the player that's going to make the biggest difference to us as a goal threat is going to be Daniel Sturridge. So if you look at all the injured players that's coming back, I'd definitely be looking at having Sturridge and can't remember now.
Sturridge and Allen on the bench, or Allen starting?
Sturridge and Sacco starting the game.
Starting.
Yeah, because I think that, you know, that they will have the biggest impact in the actual match.
Right, but you're saying you don't think he will. Conceded.
No, but I don't. I think Sturridge will be on the bench, and I think he'll start with Balotelli, and he may if Allen is fit. He may push Gerrard forward and have Lallana coming from the left-hand side and Sterling coming from the right-hand side. Despite the whole fatigue and tiredness thing, they have a full week now before the actual match. There isn't a midweek game. It's not a Wednesday game. He has a full week's rest before the actual match itself. And then he'll look to change Sterling out and bring Sturridge on, say with 55, 60 minutes gone at that point in terms of given the rest that go on there. And he can rejig your midfield in that instance, because he'll probably take Allen out as well and drop Gerrard back into the midfield and then move into a diamond as such, because you've got Chan on the bench as well. So,
Floody, if we have a situation where Sacco doesn't make it, you then could be looking at Touré and Skrtel. Is that as terrifying to you as it is to me?
Well, how fucking bad is it going to be? Like the two best centre halves we have are injured.
Yeah,
you know, I still believe Sacco is one of our best centre halves. I don't rate Skrtel at all. I think he's really poor, and I think he's off fault for a lot of mistakes that we have at the back. Touré, I would rate higher than Skrtel, but they haven't got much up front. They really don't. Like, we should be taking these asunder. If we go out and we go at this with a bit of pace and we try to cut them open, we can do it. I think if we go and we try to control the play, it'll just suit them down to the ground. And they'll just be awkward and break us down and just spoil the game, really. So I think go all out. But the two lads at the back, although I have issues with them, they should have more than enough in their locker to cope with what QPR have to offer. They sure do. They're around long enough, they played long enough, and it's a bit of a nightmare, but it's all we have.
It's probably just as well that Phil is going to be doing something of a live variety, because there's a very real possibility of a back four which
can
features,
you imagine a wonderful back four,
yes,
of
John
Glenson, Touré, Skrtel, and put Enrique back in.
Fuck it, put Enrique
back in. He's been taking great picks over in Dubai. He'll be fit and ready for this match.
That could be just like, I mean, you know, like at least three of those are very, very likely. I just thank God you've got a mic in front of you, because you won't be able to say your usual shit.
Like, seriously, right? But I do believe that Rodgers probably still favours John Glenson over Mankeo, and that's complete insanity in my mind.
Let's face it, he's going to play a decent enough part of the season. He's not completely finished yet.
His days
are numbered, obviously, and he plays less and less. But you could be looking at Johnson starting against Madrid.
Oh, Jesus.
Damien Flood, ladies and gentlemen.
Gareth Bale against Sir Trotter. Right? Do you know what I mean? It's just, oh, look, there's your man gone past me. He won't get across. Oh, yeah.
He's great going forward, though.
Anyway, look, listen, let's not think about the apocalypse at this point in time, right? Because with a bit of luck, if we have to change our centre-backs, Rodgers may think, well, look, if I go and then change my full-backs as well,
I'm changing
the whole back four when I don't really need to, right? So, you know, maybe Lovren being out injured is a blessing in disguise, because he won't drop Mankeo.
It's comforting logic to that.
Yeah, in terms of what's going on. But, like, look, at the end of it all, QPR are going to have their threats. they aren't a good side, right? Dan was right in what he says. If we can't beat QPR, then our ambitions for top four are in serious trouble, right? So, you know, going a bit back to the last game, it doesn't matter how we win this match. It's that we win this match, right? And whatever team goes out there, should, the players we have are better than the QPR players. And if they apply themselves, there's going to be a bit of rest for the England players because they had a longer break, which is good because Henderson, Lallana, Sterling all get that bit of extra rest that if they were playing a Tuesday game, they wouldn't have as such. And I think we'll come out flying, full cylinders, full throttle. Let's go. Get the result. And I think we get the result.
You think we get the result? Bloody, we get the result?
I don't see why not. I think we do. I've seen QPR. They are piss poor. They really are now. But it's the back to the lads they play across the back. They're very fucking slow. That's why I think we need to start storage there. We need to start with some pace up top. Because anything that's not mobile up there, that'll seal down to the ground.
Yeah. Andy, to wrap it up. How do you see it going?
I mean, I don't see anything other than Liverpool win. It's just, it'd be just our luck though, wouldn't it, really, to for QPR to put in a performance. But I think Sturridge comes in and we finally see Liverpool play football this season.
Maybe from the start, which would be nice, which goes back to what Floody's saying there.
Yeah, no, give the team a good lift. I mean, I think that international break came at a good time as well, after a win. And a couple of weeks to prepare for potential banana skin, potential slip up, you know. So he's no excuses now. He'll have in his mind very clear what he wants to do over the two games coming up for a quick succession. Take all 3 points.
Well, that'll do nicely. So we should probably talk about some of the other issues then. What do you think?
We're not doing predictions.
Ooh. Well, that's kind
we
of
could
prediction.
Ruin the momentum with no predictions.
Well, if you want to do a proper preview, let's do predictions. Floody, prediction.
3-0.
3-0. Andy, prediction.
3-1.
Trev, prediction. 3-0. Phil, prediction.
The hell, Trev?
4-0 QPR.
4-0 QPR, lovely.
I am Lou Schwarre. You are listening to Trippers Chat
with Trev.
Right, let's have a little chat about one of the major talking points the last couple of days, which was our friend Roy Hodgson and his quotes about Raheem Sterling and the idea of tiredness and the ensuing madness that has happened on social media and in the papers.
It's not just the social media, it's the media in general.
No, it's on the broadsheets today as well. And Roy is a broadsheet manager, so we should talk about immediate response, lads, does anyone have anything? Because I want to come back and I want to talk about what he actually said in a few minutes, because that's amazing stuff.
For me, anyway, the big thing that got to me was last week he was saying that Raheem Sterling, Liverpool needed to rest Raheem Sterling, that they'll tire him out and they'll burn him out before before he reaches his peak, etc. Right? And in the space of the week, he's then coming out and saying, well, Raheem came to me and he said he was tired and I couldn't put him in because I said, like, do you know what I mean? The fella fucking just makes it up as he goes along, basically.
Purely makes it up.
He was setting up an excuse. If they didn't beat Estonia last night, he had an excuse that one of his best players wasn't able to play because he came to him and said he was tired.
Okay, well, aside...
Because Roy Hodgson deflects blame.
Aside from the Little Englander, rabid patriot, in inverted commas, types who are saying that, you know, that's a disgrace, did anyone else believe that he wasn't just deflecting blame or setting himself up in case, like Phil says, something goes wrong? Like, have people not read him now? Like, does this sound like a realistic little transaction that happened? We were doing a light training session. Raheem had done the warm-up and he said, I'm feeling a bit tired. I'm not in my best form at the moment because I'm feeling a bit tired. So I said, best thing is, Adam Lallana starts the game and you rest and I bring you on from the bench. Simple as that. Does that sound like something that actually happened?
I mean, even if it has happened, that should never, ever, ever make it into media.
It
circuits.
Never should
Manager
be made
should
clear.
Yeah. Never yeah. fucking speak to that about anyone. That should be kept within.
He's just throwing them under the bus.
Absolute gobshite.
Yeah.
You know, like, an international manager to come out and make a comment on a player like that, like, managers should know, like, at any level, you don't go out and start speaking about what a player has said to you anywhere.
Don't hang your players.
Absolutely ridiculous. I cannot fathom it. But as Phil said, and I think everyone's seen it, he basically set himself up there to say, okay, we don't win this game, well, fucking Raheem stitched me up here, lads. Like, yeah. It wasn't my fault.
Yeah.
I would have played a different way if Raheem had him. So he's a complete fucking turd.
Well, I think the games have begun now between Hodgson and Liverpool.
Mm.
It was like after the Sturridge thing, Rodgers put the boot in, made it public that Sturridge, you know, has said that he doesn't want to, you know, he doesn't want to train. He's made train anyway, then gets injured. So Hodgson's now thinking, all right, well, if you want to make it public what I've been, what's been happening in the England camp, well, I'm going to make it public as well. So I think he's playing a few games. He's a shit manager, and he's going to try his hand at something else here. And I think he's playing a dangerous game because Rodgers now is going to dig his heels in. Lallana, Henderson, any sign that these players are fit to go to England, whereas he might have taken a chance before, he's going to say, no, fuck yourself.
So you're
gone, Hodgson.
So he's pretty much set himself up badly here, hasn't he? Like, I mean, it can't.
I think
go
he's
well
just. I think
yet.
He's just taken. I think he's taken Liverpool on. He's taken Rodgers on. You know, he's a stubborn old pissy jock fucking granddad. he wants to you know, look like Billy Big Bollocks because he's head of the FA. He's the main man in the country. Managing the England team,
he's just,
and that's how he wants to see himself as being in charge.
Yeah. He's just a horrible little shit stain. Like, basically, he's everything that annoys you about football. You know, everything he's the anti Rodgers. Mm. You know what I mean? He's Mr. Corporation. He's Mr. Yes Man. He's Mr. Yes to the media. He'll say whatever. He'll do whatever they tell him, and he'll say whatever they tell him. He has he's no personality.
Ironically, it's not bad timing, this, isn't it? It's not bad timing because people have been on Brendan's back quite considerably lately for dubious reasons. And then you have a fella like Hodgson who turns around and says something like, hang on, I just want to find this. Yeah, he's talking about the well, don't forget, it was 2 days after quite a difficult game against San Marino. It was fatigue that he hadn't managed to shake off after that San Marino game. I mean, in the name of Jesus, who is going to turn around and say San Marino is a difficult game?
I don't know.
On me. Like, I don't know.
But yeah. I mean, it's all down, you know, he's a prized asset, Raheem Sterling, for England and for Liverpool. Mm. And there's a bit of tug of war going on here. Rodgers criticises England for overusing, then he drops him against Villa and we pay the consequences. Then, you know, you think, oh, Rodgers is looking after Sterling, and then he plays him for 120 minutes against Middlesbrough and then again in the derby.
Mm.
So, you know, what's going on? Like,
yeah, but doesn't it show you the level of people's stupidity that there's actually a debate about this today, and people are coming out and saying things like, you know, it's a disgrace, and, you know, footballers with their wages, etc., etc. You know, I mean, like, this debate should not be happening.
Wages, money doesn't stop you getting tired. Right?
Stop you getting
tired. But Sterling's played 400,000 games this season. And
Don't forget,
he has six kids as well.
Six imaginary kids to look after as well when he gets home. But no, you think about it, right? We mentioned a couple of weeks back and he was rested, you know, for the Aston Villa game. And then after the Aston Villa game, we can't afford to rest him at the moment because we've got too many players out and we're missing Sturridge and you can't afford to leave Sterling out. Simple fact is, at the end of it all, that Liverpool Football Club is more important to Raheem Sterling in real terms because that's where he's playing week in, week out. They know what's best for his development. They have better sports scientists, etc. behind them, as was proven the last time that Daniel Sturridge went away and England just completely ignored what everyone was telling them because of the way Liverpool were managing his injuries to get him through so he stopped picking up recurrent injuries, right? Mm. And that was just laughed and joked off. And don't forget that this is the same England setup where Hodgson wanted Sturridge to prove himself when he got injured that time. To play through the fucking injury.
To test his resolve.
And in that game, didn't he come back? Didn't he protect Rooney and take him off after 65 minutes because he was carrying a little bit of a knock?
Yeah.
And made Sturridge finish the fucking whole 90 that threw an injury.
So this fella's a horrible prick, right?
Yeah.
He darkened our doorstep for too long, those 6 horrible months that he was there for, right? And, you know, that hasn't changed. He's taken his shit medits to many clubs. And he's managed to do fuck all with them. And he's taken them on to England and he's done fuck all with them. And he's managed to charlatanize himself into a fucking job. And somehow he's had a horrific World Cup and he's come out and he's still the manager.
Mm.
If that was any other England manager, and I mean any other England manager, they would have walked the plank in the Caribbean after the World Cup because they wouldn't have got back into England.
Imagine McLaren or someone.
Bobby Robson in Euro 88. Was nearly run out of town because they didn't do well in that European Championships. Mm. And that was in a group that had an Ireland team that was coming through, that had Russia, that was at the height of its power, it was the USSR, and also Holland. And Holland went on to win it in the end, right? And he went on, Robson went on, now I suppose the lesson here is Robson went on and they got to the semi-finals in 1990. But Robson was one of the best managers in the world at the time and had a tactical brilliance about him. Whereas this fella is a fucking gimp. Mm. Look, quite simply.
But he suits them down to the ground. Like everything from his comments about Rooney and the Scouse accent, and he's a hang.
The FA, you mean, suits them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, and he, you know, the sort of discrimination that you've seen over the years towards Liverpool, like, and Liverpool player, young Liverpool players not getting involved in the England Academy. Mm. Like, you look at Fowler and the likes over the years. So there's this thing that, you know, discriminating against the Northerners, like, and the Scousers to them are just scum. And I think that's his opinion also. And so behind the scenes, they suit each other up down to the ground. Mm-hmm. You know, he doesn't like what's happening. He doesn't like Liverpool at all. When he came up, didn't he have an argument over getting into the players' lounge?
Stick him in the jacks the next time in the fucking underneath the main stand.
They wouldn't let him in.
You know,
they wouldn't let him in. They told him to go and sit in some room in a cupboard. Go sit in a cupboard. Strangely enough,
there's bad blood. He's typical of them. You know, that's why they suit each other.
And he's a spiteful little bollocks. Mm. Like, you've seen the way he reacts to Norwegian media and stuff like that, the Danish media, everything like that. He's spiteful and he carries around a massive chip on his shoulder, being an owl that he is. He just carries those chips everywhere.
Owls are particularly noted
noted for their spitefulness.
They
attract those field mice for miles just to get the bastards. Mm.
Should we talk
about
it?
You're looking at me, I mean, he knows the cameras on him all the time. He's trying to act cool, you know. And it couldn't come out more the complete opposite of what he's trying to do. The faces he pulls, like, I think in his head he thinks he looks like Mourinho. I look cool right now. No, you fucking don't.
The face melting off.
Right. Okay, chaps, I want to talk to you about Mr. Enrique's naked Dubai adventures. What do we make of that? How wonderful is this man? Floody, earlier on you called him a hero. Would you stand by that?
In what sense? Fucking hell. That is an absolute balloon. Like, you get arrested over there for kissing your girlfriend in public. Like,
I know.
You must have left the country before he tweeted the fucking picture. Yeah, just in case the 5-0 knocked on the door. Listen, your flute's all over the internet. Like, it's in the void.
Ah, but that's the point.
That's the thing.
He positioned the marina just in front of his.
So the marina is marina looks like a flute. Straight up, Jose.
And there's no way he didn't practice at least 18 times that. That's not a random shot. Like, he's gotten himself into the crowd. Position there, hasn't he? Definitely.
No, I don't think he thinks.
Do you not?
I don't think.
Just a lucky shot, wasn't it?
Enrique engages the brain at all.
Yeah.
Like, nothing he does on Twitter makes any fucking sense. There's no forethought into anything. Yeah. You know, I don't mind him now. Like, I give out shit about players not being professional on Twitter, but. In fairness, he doesn't get engaged with the fans. He doesn't get stuck in, and he doesn't start giving slagging back or anything like that.
He just shows pictures of him and a monkey, and he's fucking happy.
He's just a happy-go-lucky, good-time guy. What's the crack?
Yeah.
You know?
But, like, you can't...
If he turns up at training someday and he has a chimpanzee and hanging out of him, right, as his pet chimp, nobody would even bat an eyelid. Nobody would think to themselves,
Jose,
that's weird.
Yeah.
Where's he getting a monkey from?
Yeah.
I say, oh, sure, is that the same monkey that was in your car?
He's fucking unhinged. Yeah.
Oh, that's the lad from the picture. That's the fella from the picture.
Yeah, yeah.
What's his name?
Yeah, I know.
I call him Fernando.
He's just, you know.
I think he's... Like, he's the best thing. Like, you know, all the social media, and you get them on, they're all robots when they go on, but he's just brilliant. Like, the stuff he does, it's harmless. It's a bit like the rap that Balotelli has. Most of the stuff he does is completely harmless as well. Like, it's just mental. It's like, seriously, I'm with you. I think he practiced that shot. I can't wait until they raid iCloud again and get all the photographs, right? Because we get to see all the practice shots at once. How many practice shots to get?
Definitely, where there's no boat in the way.
It's definitely a practice shot, because if you take a picture at a window at an angle, you won't get a reflection like that. You know, he's had to go down at the level to get the fucking
There have been drafts. That's what makes it really even better. Right, a couple of questions in from our listeners, and the first one here is from Amrit, and he wonders, lads, what's the stupidest thing you've ever bought?
I bought an electronic pipe.
Well, that was
they're smoking it now.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that's an electronic cigarette.
Which you brought in, which you actually brought in here to show us.
Yeah, a fake wooden electric pipe.
And actually, you only broke it fucking out when I was in the middle of a serious intro, and I looked around and you were there with that fucking Sherlock Holmes thing.
Yeah, I was going through a Sherlock Holmes phase. I was trying to buy one of those hunter hats as well. So,
how do you justify buying an electronic pipe?
I just thought to myself, a bit of class about that.
Yeah.
I look good now if I'm in the pub and I have the pipe instead of the electronics.
You wouldn't do that, would you? You did, didn't you? Oh, Jesus Christ. Bloody the stupidest thing you ever bought.
I'm trying to rack my brains. The worst I probably a good few years ago, I said I'd buy a pair of training boots. Cheaper pair of training boots. And I bought a pair of Kelme because I thought they were killed from Spain.
Right.
Wore them for 2 training sessions and my arches collapsed on both my feet. That's not one of the lies. That's a fucking bad you wear.
That's an anti ad.
It was horrific.
Yeah. No sponsorship from that lot for us now.
No.
Okay. Andy, any suggestions for the stupidest thing you ever bought?
I used to buy a sports item from pretty much every sport. Like, at one stage, I had a baseball bat, a fucking tennis rackets, fucking everything. The open boot of my car to be like football boots, me golf clubs, and a snooker cue.
And was it an OCD thing?
Table tennis, what?
Was it an OCD thing? Like, were you ever thinking of using them? Like?
It was just, I'd be watching telly, and next thing I'd see two fellas playing table tennis or something, and I go,
oh, fuck them,
I'm getting them.
I could beat them.
I'm taking up table tennis now. Or like, and mad things like squash rackets and all. I've never played squash even, like, and I had a squash racket.
Basically, if you go into Aldi or Lidl, there's a good chance you're going to come out with problem. Some of the stupidest things ever.
With a chainsaw.
And a wetsuit.
And a pair of cycling gloves.
What are you after? I'm doing a bit of underwater chainsaw.
Yeah, you know yourself. Paul Murray is wondering, this is an interesting one for, actually, hold on, I'm asking you boys from city boys that you are. He wonders how the routine of milking cows was discovered. In other words, how did people discover that stuff that comes out of that thing, you could actually digest it, and it was lovely? Anyone have ideas?
And there's a few videos like that.
I said he got a surprise when he tried the bull. It's taking a bit long.
Yeah.
Not quite
as tasty in hot chocolate, but
it's very warm.
Yeah, moving swiftly.
I know milk is warm that comes out of cows.
Oh, Jesus.
It's not salty, though.
No, it's not salty.
For fuck's sake. Barry Carr, we'll finish with Barry's question. Barry wants to know, what's your favourite animal noise to reproduce? So, at your leisure, gents, your favourite animal noise.
Down.
Bloody, what are you going to do?
I'm not going to fucking.
Andy, you got one?
Any requests?
Jesus. You've got a variety, have you?
Do a lima.
Gonna give a
lima.
I'll give a cow a bash.
Go for a cow, yeah. Go for a cow. You're regretting this already, Anna.
How do you do it?
In one.
Fucking brilliant. Funny star.
Do it again. Do it again. In two.
I'm bully special, Brad.
I'm not open for it.
Phil, can you follow that?
Excuse you, Phil.
I'm right. And we finish as we always do with some admin. Irish listeners who like playing football should come and do so here at Astro Park. You can book your pitch time at astropark.ie. On our website, lfcdaytrippers.com, we've lots of stuff there that will interest you. Fantastic articles from some very fine writers indeed. The day trip we spoke to you about over the last couple of weeks is on November the 1st. LFC fans from all over the country will be heading to Waterford for an overnighter in the Dooley Hotel. We're going to be there. We're going to be recording something. So if you want to get involved, get on to YNWA Irish Reds. As we said at the top of the show, you should get into the Stone Bolton Sunday early for a bit of crack and a bit of a laugh. We might even record something that's not too libelous and no fights break out. So we probably won't record anything. Your day trippers tonight were Darren Kelly, Joe Pepper, Dan Kenneth, and the young Damo Floyd, Phil Casey, and myself, Trev Downey.